This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. How will the coronavirus pandemic affect voting? Everyone's watching how incumbents are responding to the outbreak, and the disarray among federal agencies is sending the internet into wild speculation over both the origins and severity of the disease. Meanwhile, precarious workers are suffering through the economic slowdown. Some candidates are taking this opportunity to champion paid sick leave policy, healthcare access, and raising the minimum wage. But what are voters going to remember come November? Is it the panic or the promises? This much we know, the political junkie Ken Rudin remembers everything. Ken, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you. What's your name again?
Exactly. It's hard. It's really hard to keep track in this week of insanity. So take us, Ken, into the midst of all of this. North Carolina, we know, is in a state of emergency. Public schools are starting to shut down. We heard that D.C. schools are now closing. So take us to what's happening on the statewide level. What do you make of how leaders are responding?
Well, the reason I think that's such a great question is because the leadership one would expect from the federal government, i.e. the president of the United States, is not happening, let alone the fact that there's a lack of empathy. But when the president for weeks has been talking about blaming the Democrats, blaming the Fed, blaming the media for the severity of it, his own administration officials have said the same thing, that it's a plot to hurt him in November. Then it's other people like state governors and local officials who have to step up, and they have for the most part. And I would think that, for example, in North Carolina, where it seems like, I don't know if things have changed lately, but I know that Governor Cooper has talked about voluntary closing schools or voluntarily banning gatherings of more than 100 people. But for other states, it's not voluntary. I live in Maryland, right outside of D.C., and there are only 12 people have tested positive for the virus, and they've closed all the schools. And there's like, 5 million students affected around with all these states closing the schools. So I think the governors are stepping up in ways that the federal government absolutely is not.
Well, yeah. I mean, you've said, the president's statements even Wednesday evening left a lot of people confused. There were some errors in his announcement talking about things related to the travel ban that weren't completely accurate. He had to be fact-checked and corrected afterward. But I wonder...
It's not only that. I mean, he's talking about closing. You close the borders, but not to the United Kingdom. Why not the United Kingdom? Why not mention Australia? Everybody in the world knows that Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson got the coronavirus from Australia.
Right.
Why is there not a ban there? There's so many inconsistencies and confusion. And again, there's no, and the president says there's no problem. He's shaken hands with members of Congress who have since self-quarantined because of fears of the virus. At least the rest of the world. I mean, I think that's why there's so much panic. There's panic buying. There's tremendous sell-offs on Wall Street, and I think it's because there's no sense of. I mean, when the president goes to the CDC and says that I know more than the health officials because I'm a genius because my uncle was very smart at MIT, or I mean, he says he's smarter than the generals. He's smarter than the intelligence officials. And he knows more than anybody else. There is a fear that, look, when Dr. Fauci says that we're probably a year away from a vaccine, and the president says, oh, no, I really want it to be a couple of months, he contradicts his own health officials, and that sets in to this mindset in the country that we are suffering from a tremendous lack of confidence.
Well, Democrats have also peddled in misinformation a bit. I mean, in talking about Trump cutting funding to the CDC, you had Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Chris Murphy both making those claims, not totally accurate. So there's a lot of rhetoric all of the time. But let's take it just away from the president for a moment and look at the Democratic candidates. What has their response been to all of this, and how are they using this to support their candidacy?
Well, I mean, other than the fact that they've canceled rallies, I mean, of course, they've done that. Of course, they did this emphatically, whereas the president kind of was forced into canceling his Florida rally. I mean, look, for Bernie Sanders, health care and the affordability of health care has always been a key issue for him. I don't see much daylight between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden on the issues of how to deal with the coronavirus. Obviously, the Democrats are feeling that rather than have this cut payroll taxes, which, I mean, it's fine and dandy, but it doesn't help anybody who was laid off or furloughed because of that. All the restaurant workers who have to stay home because the restaurants are closed. So I think the Democrats are talking more about paid sick leave and unemployment insurance and things like that, rather than just, you know, massive tax cuts.
But in terms of no daylight, I mean, I think there is an opportunity here for, you know, more dialogue around some of the healthcare related policies like Medicare for All. People are really concerned in this moment. So do you think there are any lasting effects of some of Bernie Sanders' policies on the Democratic Party platform, even if he may not have the votes to make it past the next week or so? Do you think this could have long-term effects?
Well, I mean, I would, for, there are two things on that, and that's a very fair question, Nita. But I, like, for example, if Medicare for All was a selling argument, then I think Bernie Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren would have done much better than they're doing now. Now, obviously, this crisis may change the dialogue a little bit, but I suspect in the bigger picture, there's some of the things that Bernie Sanders wants to accomplish, which of course is led by Medicare for All, but it's also, you know, the $15 minimum wage and you know, changing trade policies. The fact that, and I think you're right, the fact is, and I can't believe we're writing him off. We're really not writing him off for the nomination, but 2 weeks ago we were writing Joe Biden off. So, you know, things could change in a heartbeat. But the fact is that there's so many parentheticals to this sentence I just gave you. But having said that, if Joe Biden is the nominee, what Bernie Sanders can do and wants to do is shape the Democratic Party, shape the Democratic nominee, move him a little bit to the left, but also move the Democratic Party to the left on issues that have been very key to Bernie Sanders and his supporters.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about what's going on right now. Congress still working, the House Democrats and the Treasury working on a deal still this morning to pass a multi-billion dollar proposal. Talk about your analysis of what the kind of political negotiations are around this proposal they're trying to pass to provide some relief.
Well, see, the sad thing about this is that it has become political. And thank you, Anita, for pointing out that the Democrats have overreacted to and may not have always given the up and up on some of the facts as well. And that's true as well. But the fact is that there is a D proposal and there's an R proposal. And of course, everybody's demanding an American proposal. I mean, John Edwards would always talk about, you know, there's no rich country, there's no poor country, there's just one country. But I think the fact is that that both parties are seeing it differently, and the Republicans are still talking about tax cut holidays and things like that, and whereas the Democrats are saying that individual people who are affected need the kind of help that they're not getting from the federal government. So both sides are not seeing they're not eye to eye on the issue. Although I think as it spreads, I mean, look, you know, maybe it's not serious, but when you start canceling NAACP March Madness.
NCAA.
And the NAA, NBA, and Major League Baseball, then people say, wait a second, this is a real serious crisis. So I kind of think that ultimately, I mean, not because more and more members of Congress are getting in, and now it's up to five, I think, who are self-quarantined because of what's going on. But if the American people says, look, something has got to done, you've got to stop fighting like children in the schoolyard, something ultimately does get done, and maybe we could stop the sniping between the Kevin McCarthys and the Nancy Pelosi's in Congress.
All right, Ken, I want to end with some historical analysis here. Take us back to kind of any other time in recent history that you can think of that parallels this moment. I know nothing will be quite exact. And what kind of leadership response you've seen at that stage?
Well, I've never seen politics like it is today, and I've never, you know, of course, this is a crisis, a health crisis that I've never seen before. But when you think of presidential leadership, and you think of Ronald Reagan after the Challenger explosion, and you think of Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City, and you think of George W. Bush after 9/11, and even Barack Obama after gun violence, they would go before the American people and assure them that, you know, we feel your pain, and that sounds like a cliche, but we feel your pain and we're working for you. When I watched and listened to President Trump the other day, I guess Wednesday, talking about his response, it seemed so mechanical, so unemotional. And it comes at a time when American people are emotional because of what's going on. There is a crisis of confidence and a crisis of leadership in the White House.
Who's stepping up? Whose leadership are you impressed by right now?
Well, you know something? I had to hesitate for a second, but I'm thinking there are governors and school superintendents and people like that who are not waiting for signals from the White House because the signals are not coming. I'm impressed with Anthony Fauci, who has no fear of contradicting the president because the facts have to come out. So there are people who are not giants in the world, but whose voices and opinions are well respected. They are stepping forward.
All right, Ken, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands, and we will talk to you soon.
Oh, whenever I talk to you on the phone, I have gloves on.
All right, Ken Rudin is the political junkie. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.